Governor Holcomb vetoes an agency rulemaking measure. Indiana's U.S. senators split on spending bill, plus permanent daylight saving time and more on Indiana Week in Review for the week ending March 18th, 2022.
Indiana Week in Review is made possible by the supporters of Indiana Public Broadcasting Stations.
This week, Governor Eric Holcomb issued his first veto of 2022, citing concerns about House Bill 1211's effect on broadband projects and state agency emergency rules. In his veto letter, Holcomb said the entirely new and unvetted broadband language could jeopardize $154 million of projects across 28 counties from his Ready Grant initiative. He also cited concerns about the language of a bill to make it harder for Indiana state agencies to create new rules, which was also added to HB 1211 on the last day of session. A Senate committee halted the original rulemaking bill, promising to return to the issue next year. State agencies each year pass dozens of administrative rules. They're often the nuts and bolts to keep the state running. 1211 also required state agencies to submit emergency rules for approval to the Attorney General's office. In his veto letter, Holcomb said he was concerned about the delay the review could cause and said alternative language could have solved this problem. Will lawmakers override this veto of the governor's? It's the first question for our Indiana Week in Review panel. Democrat, Drew Anderson. Republican, Chris Mitchum. John Schwannis, host of Indiana Lawmakers. And Nikki Kelly, State House reporter for the Fort Wayne Journal-Gazette. I'm Indiana Public Broadcasting State House reporter Brandon Smith. Drew Anderson, was Holcomb right to veto this bill?
I mean, of course he was. And you know what? He's vouching for the American Rescue Plan, President Joe Biden, because the rescue plan is paying for all these ready funding. It's $500 million. And at the end of the day, Democrats are never going to fault him on that. But going back to your point at the beginning, what's going to happen next at the State House? Because check me here, Nikki. The State House has overridden his veto, what, three times before? All on local issues. If they do it again, they're kind of doing that thing where they're proving that they're the party of the big brother. And I'm old enough to remember where they used to be all about local control. So they're kind of proving everyone wrong there.
Chris, there might be another veto coming from the governor. We don't know that yet. He's got a few more days to decide. And that's a bigger one that it feels like lawmakers would definitely want to come back in and override. But
absolutely,
if this is the only veto of the session, do they come back in and override this one?
I don't know. That's a great question, because I'll be honest. When I initially saw the veto come through, obviously you have that agency rulemaking language in there. And I genuinely thought when I read the letter that this broadband language is not necessarily a front, but maybe a reason to veto that language that we know the governor's office did not like from the very beginning. But then I did a little bit of digging, and I saw the qualifications of these ready grants versus the rural broadband grants. And obviously the rural broadband grants are more tailored towards providers, which, as you can imagine, has more strict kind of regulations of how to go about these. So whenever you are trying to align, you know, public units of government with these more strict provider regulations, I can see how that could potentially cause a lot of issues when it comes to stalling a lot of projects that are already in the works of this Ready program. But even when you get to this, the agency regulation language, I don't think it's unreasonable when you look at Governor Holcomb to see, the details of this regulation being, if you make an emergency rule after 6 months, if it's still an emergency, you might have to get additional approval to make sure that continues to go through. I think that's a fairly reasonable expectation when it comes to agency rulemaking. But when it comes to the legislature coming in, potentially vetoing this, I don't see them pushing for an emergency session when it comes to something like this.
John, we've talked a lot about process the last few weeks when it comes to the legislature and some of the things they've been doing. Is process somewhat at the heart of this veto, too?
Process and the traditional roles of the various branches of government. Let's put it maybe more that way. Because we've seen, and we've talked about this off and on over the past year or two, this, what I sense, is an encroachment by the General Assembly into the domain that had formerly been reserved for experts either at the state level within the agencies or even at the local level. And to Drew's point, even locally elected officials have ceded some of their control and responsibility to the General Assembly. So whether that is a matter of protocol or a violation of tradition, I guess we could argue the semantics. But it is it is a change in course, it seems to me, and it does, certainly as it relates to local government, it does run afoul of the Republican traditional mantra of that government, which is closest to the people, is that, you know, I'm butchering the phrase.
They're butchering the policy.
I never claim to be a poet, but and then at the state level, it's this notion of where does the expertise of people who do this for a career, whether you're talking about, you know, veterinary medicine or pharmacology or the environment or energy, do lawmakers really want to be responsible for rulemaking in those areas? It may be more than they on their plate than they
well,
even
they
wanted to do
be,
it.
Do they want to be responsible for rulemaking, or do they just not want anybody to make any rules?
It's maybe a little of both. And don't forget the Attorney General review aspect of this, mm-hmm. where you have the emergency rules would go to somebody who has and it becomes something of a thorn in the governor's side with Padre, even though they're the same party.
On the broadband stuff, potentially messing with these ready projects, we've already seen in a separate issue some of the ready projects being screwed around with a little bit. So this just piles onto that, doesn't it?
The federal government has, you know, when they finally put out their rules on how that money can be used, some of the projects that were put forward just aren't going to meet those. So we're already having that trouble. Now this would be a second. I did talk to a few lawmakers, and clearly that language had not been vetted the entire session. It wasn't. And so a few lawmakers that I talked to did not know it would affect that many projects, what, $154 million worth of projects in 28 counties. So I know what they were trying to do. They were saying, you know, we need to focus on the areas that need it most, but those weren't the rules that were put in place when all those communities put those plans together.
Right. Make sure we have quality projects, yeah. Right? I think that was the main crux of it, which I completely understand. It's maybe if it did go through that vetting process, then maybe we'd catch more of those discrepancies.
Indiana U.S. Senators Todd Young and Mike Braun split in a recent vote on a massive $1 trillion-plus spending package that also provides more than $13 billion in aid to Ukraine. The measure signed into law late last Friday by President Biden avoided a looming government shutdown by funding it through its fiscal year at the end of September. The overall spending package includes a roughly 5.5% increase in defense spending over current levels, along with about 6.5% increase for non-defense spending. The $13.6 billion in the measure for Ukraine includes money for humanitarian aid, defense assistance, and economic support for the region. In a statement, Senator Todd Young, who voted for it, highlighted some of his priorities in the bill, including extended coverage of telehealth services for older Americans and the support for Ukraine. Senator Mike Braun, who voted against the package, issued a simple statement calling the spending bill a disgrace that spends more money on swamp earmarks than help for Ukraine.
Chris Mitchum, Todd Young voted for a package that Mike Braun said spends another $1 trillion that we don't have. Is that going to hurt him with conservative voters this fall?
I don't think so. And I think that question would mean a lot more if Todd Young had a primary come May. The fact that he doesn't and he's not really pressured to necessarily cater to the further right of the Republican Party, I think that makes this vote not truly impactful in the long run. I mean, as John likes to say, you know, voters like to have a short-term memory. So I think come November, the idea of this being a big talking point is probably pretty low. And even if he did have a primary, I think it's hard to challenge somebody who can say, yes, I voted to send billions of dollars to what might be one of the biggest humanitarian crises, you know, of our generation. But when you look at Senator Braun's point, I totally understand where he's coming from. I mean, I'm still kind of patiently waiting for somebody in Congress to kind of make it a big point of saying this national debt is kind of getting out of hand. I mean, you see this excessive spending by, you know, the Biden administration and House and Senate Democrats. It's when are we going to get this reined in? When is this kind of going to come to fruition? Is it going to be impacting our grandchildren, our grandchildren's children? You know, it's got to come due eventually. And I can also see Senator Braun kind of having a bigger stake in this, being that he offered an amendment that would have cut $8 billion in kind of this earmarked funds that would go to different things. I think one of my favorite ones was in this bill, there's $1.8 million going to aquaculture equity, I believe it is, which, I mean, could be a priority to some, but to average American, I don't think that's necessarily might want to be where their taxpayers go.
Drew, So Chris kind of just laid it out. Todd Young, in voting for it, gets to say, I helped Ukraine, as well as highlighted some other spending priorities that he cared about. Mike Braun gets to say, well, this is just way too much money, and $1 trillion is a lot of money to the average person. So if you're Mike Braun, though, are you worried that someone's going to club you over the head with you didn't help Ukraine? Somebody who, I don't know, works for the Indiana Democratic Party?
I mean, at the end of the day, Mike Braun would have voted no on anything that cost more than a dollar in D.C. So when it comes to Todd Young, I talked to Mayor McDermott actually this week, and he's chomping at the bit to make this an issue on the campaign trail because this is now $9 trillion that Todd Young oversaw in Congress, in the Senate, that he allowed to be added to the debt. So what you're talking about, Chris, I hear you, but the Republicans literally try to have their cake and eat it too on this issue every single time a Democrat is in the White House, because they're all quiet when a Republican's hanging out in there, but then the moment a Democrat gets on board, they're all screaming about it. And that's just political stunts and partisanship to the T.
How much do you think this, both of these votes were shaped by Todd Young not having a primary and Mike Braun not having to run for anything for at least a couple more years?
Yeah, I'm not sure it really matters that much. The fact is, when you're talking about $1.5 trillion, you can find a lot in a bill you like, and you can easily find stuff you don't like. So, I mean, it's just sort of the weight of what you want to give it. And obviously, the Ukraine money was important, but it was less than 1% of that bill's spending. So, I mean, $15 billion is a lot, but not compared to $1.5 trillion.
How much... We keep talking about these massive spending packages. Yes, under President Trump, then under President Biden, and going back further than that.
Yeah.
How much is the average American starting to just tune out $1 trillion, or, you know, billion or trillion dollar spending package after spending package?
They may, I think, be tuning out a little bit about that. I think they seize on certain elements of it. I think they are supportive right now of helping Ukraine.
That's a simple thing.
Another one you could break out, and again, it's a tiny fraction, but I could see veterans and military officials saying, this is the first significant funding we've had to clean up toxins and carcinogens around military bases, burn pits, and so forth. Gee, Mike Braun, you voted against that. This is, forget Ukrainian soldiers. What about American soldiers? I mean, you can do play that game. The bigger issue that's, I think, purely political, and it's the slogan game, is the notion, we saw it with references to swamp and this kind of thing, is earmarks generally. You can call earmarks pork barrel. You can call them, you know, lining your own pockets. But actually, there are a lot of people who say we desperately need what we have, which is return to direct funding, because that's sort of the oil that makes the process work. And there are a lot of political scientists. I know people would make fun of people who study this for a living, but they're smart people, so we should listen to them. They will tell you, and a lot of former members of Congress too, that this
that's
is what's response.
Smart people.
This is responsive. They're viewers of this show, is what I'm trying to say. They the ban in 2011 on earmarks really contributed a great deal to the gridlock that has so frustrated the American public. And now that with their back, there are rules. So don't just say it's swamp. You have a new layer of transparency. They have to have sponsors attached to them. They have to be released to the public in advance. There are limits on them in terms of the overall funding percentage, limits on how many each member can request. It's not your grandfather's or father's earmark. And we should remember that. Because it will probably make, well, it did. We have empirical evidence. This went through on a bipartisan basis, and it wouldn't without the earmark.
And you know what? It adds funding, infrastructure funding in the region. So there's some direct benefit already happening in Indiana. It's because Congressman Mervan, I'll give credit to Todd Young on that one too, they delivered infrastructure funding to the state.
But you can't say that Senator Braun didn't have a point. I mean, even his amendment that his staff went through and earmarked $8 billion, that's still not even a fraction of the percentage of what this $1 trillion was. So imagine what other things that are in there. I think we need to be kind of calling for increased accountability to, you know, our partners.
But if you're on the short end of that aquaculture inequity, this is a serious issue for you. So, I mean, one person's earmark is another person's lifeline.
So. Mm-hmm. The Senate passed a bill this week that would make daylight saving time permanent across the U.S. beginning in 2023. The so-called Sunshine Protection Act of 2021, which I really love, was approved by unanimous consent, meaning no recorded vote, but would still require House approval and President Biden's signature to become law.
Daylight saving time currently makes up roughly 8 months of the year, with the remainder called standard time. It began as a bid to pack more hours of sunlight into the day during the summer months and cut down on energy use, though critics question how effective it's been toward that goal. Instead, health experts say switching our clocks twice a year has led to an uptick in sleep deprivation and other health problems. An Economist YouGov poll from last fall found that 63% of American adults want to eliminate the biannual changing of clocks. It also found that more people support instituting daylight saving time permanently rather than standard time.
John Schwanis, first, we're in Indiana, so I felt compelled by law, I think, to discuss this topic this week on the show. But is this an idea whose time has come?
Well, it seems to come every few decades, because we wrestled with this back to, I think, around World War I, going one direction and then another. But I think you have to divide the issue. If this is about changing the clock twice a year, I think most everybody says, let's get rid of that. Because mm-hmm. if you look at traffic fatality data, there's a spike. If you yep. look at crime, we don't do well when we get off schedule for even an hour, apparently, as human beings. The bigger debate is whether we should stay on standard time or daylight saving time. Now, I'm a night owl. I love sunshine in the afternoon. I love summer.
So you're a daylight saving
time guy. I'm a daylight saving time guy. But I understand also that a lot in the education community, a lot of people who, physicians, I think you look at most medical groups are going to come out, and never mind sleep specialists who are crying foul here. They say that the body, and we'll get into the release of whatever causes us to do what we do as humans, is much more akin to the standard schedule. So, and they say they weren't consulted before the Senate, the education groups.
Apparently no one was.
So they're going to weigh in now. So I think the debate, there's three debates. Is that an option? This option, is it going, no changes, but sticking with going with standard, or leaving it the way it is? So who knows where that
to that point ends up. Let's say, which debate do we need to have first, changing the clocks or choosing?
Well, the fact is that for most of the country, there isn't much of a debate. We are very particular because we're right in the middle. We're mm-hmm. on the edge of a time zone. So, most of the people would be like, great, I don't want to change my clocks every, twice a year. Perfect. We love this. But Indiana is in a weird position. And so then we go to the second part, which is, do we want to wake up in the morning when it's dark literally all the time? Like, it's not going to be light until like 9 a.m.
Yeah.
Or do we want to,
have a late sunset.
Right. 10 yeah. p.m. sunset. So, and it becomes very particular to just your own, you said you're a night owl. So you would like one way, and no one's right or wrong.
Well, that
really is
right in this case. But generally speaking,
is the second part of the debate, which to choose if we stop changing clocks, going to be what stops the first one from even happening? Because nobody can agree on the second part. We just won't do the first part, and we'll keep the system the way it is.
I mean, I think at the end of the day, let's remind ourselves, and Nikki, you were covering the State House, and you may have too, Brandon, but we didn't switch our clocks up until 2005. And who made it a priority?
Mitch Daniels.
So at the end of the day, I think the debate is not just about whether or not we stick with daylight savings or standard time. It's, do we want it to stay in Eastern time or Central time? Because personally, Central time is where it's at, for March Madness days.
As a person from Southwest Indiana, Central time is God's time zone.
Is that going to be more sunlight at night or not? I've got to think about that.
Less. I'm an early bird, so I dig it.
Okay.
As a Chicagoan, moving here to Eastern time, that was maybe the biggest adjustment I had to make to being on Eastern. Yeah. It's not great. And so then my question to you then is, and I think I know your answer obviously already, but if they made... whether they make daylight saving time or standard time permanent, if that's the change that the Congress makes, does Indiana need to have a serious debate about which time zone to be in?
Oh, absolutely. Just because if you have that change at the federal level, that's automatically going to kind of trigger a discussion you're going to have at the state level.
But that's a county-by-county decision. Yeah, that's the way it's handled right now.
Well, right now, do you think that would change? Would the state have to make a final decision on that?
But I'm not even sure they can, because right now, don't you have to petition the federal government for them to switch it?
Well, if the feds change it, though, I guess.
Yeah, if the feds change it, they'd probably amenable to that. Yeah. Are you looking forward to covering something like that?
No.
I wasn't here for that, so.
It was crazy, and, God bless Troy Woodruff, who lost his seat because of that whole thing.
I saw some old pictures of people breaking out grass at the stadium.
Oh, yeah. I saw that Jerry Tor picture.
The cows have finally gotten used to it. Now we're going to mess them up.
Bring that back around. around.
Yeah. Time now for viewer feedback. Each week we pose an unscientific online poll question, and this week's question is, should the U.S. make daylight saving time permanent? Yes, no, the clocks should continue to change, or no, it should make standard time permanent. Last week's question, will most Hoosiers feel the impact of an individual income tax cut that's spaced out over at least 7 years? Just 13% of you say yes, 87% of you say no. If you'd like to take part in the poll, go to wfyi.org/IWIR and look for the poll. Well, Attorney General Todd Rokita's office spent about $2,400 sending two staffers and Rokita to a Texas border briefing in January, new records show. In a story this week by the Fort Wayne Journal-Gazette's Nikki Kelly, hey, we know her. The costs include flights, gas, a rental car, hotels, a phone charger, and a new tire. Rokita's son was on at least part of the trip, and the Attorney General attended a rally by former President Donald Trump while driving back to Indiana. The Journal-Gazette reports that the AG's office says no taxpayer dollars were spent on Rokita's son, with Rokita paying for all expenses related to his presence. Rokita, along with about a dozen other Republican attorneys general, went to Texas in late January at the invitation of the governor of Texas for a border security briefing. And while there, Rokita finalized and announced a multi-state lawsuit challenging the Biden administration's handling of undocumented immigrants. But some have criticized the AG for spending tax dollars on a trip states away from Indiana and on a topic that's largely federal. According to documents provided to the Journal-Gazette, Rokita drove a state vehicle down to Texas while one staffer rode with him, and another took a round-trip flight costing $628. Nikki Kelly, do these new details that you uncovered shed more light on whether this trip was appropriate when funded by taxpayers?
Not really. I mean, yeah, they give us the exact dollar amounts. But other than that, I think you either feel like, you know, he was doing some work down there. He filed a lawsuit while he was down there. You know, if you
He was unquestionably doing a lot of official work.
Right. And I think had the son not been involved and the Trump rally, I think if he just went to a border briefing and came back, I don't think a lot of people could have had a lot of, you know, serious, you know, offense to it. But when you add those things in, and does he need two staffers with him? You know, it starts to add to the question.
John Tron, is voters care much about this sort of thing anymore? It feels like they used to care more about it. Do they still?
I think it depends on how it's framed. And it depends on the wherewithal of the critic to bring it to the public's attention in a way that they understand and can become outraged with. So in other words, by that I mean if you have critics within the Republican Party or, more likely, critics across the aisle in the Democratic Party who see it's of value to run a spot that says, and you can just see like the tax ticker going here, what it costs, you know, and then you have a little car with a little thing tooling down the road, and then you detour over to a Trump rally, and then you detour, oh, son,
oh
come along,
like
you know, we do
writing the whole
app. You get a lot of ideas.
All the ideas.
If you do that with a little matchbox
this
cars,
in a couple of years.
That, I think, it depends, you know, people seize on what they can understand, and really the question is answered by the opponents, who, will they frame it the way that the public can seize
well,
on or
to
not?
Well, to that point, though, part of the statement in Nikki's story from Rokita's office was that this is sort of the fact that his son went along is sort of like a philosophy in the office, a family-focused, family-first, welcoming sort of thing.
Which you can't like disregard that, or you can't like talk down upon that. I mean, you know,
Does that shield him a little bit in any sort of criticism about this?
Yeah, I think the question comes in whenever you're starting to use taxpayer dollar on your son, which the office came out and said they didn't. That was fully, you know.
Yeah, although they didn't answer questions like, did he stay in the room in the hotel room that was paid for? Like those, we still don't know that. Yeah.
And all of this ultimately, I mean, if this was his own prerogative of just going down there and being like, hey, let's you know, go on a little trip. He was ultimately invited by a governor of another state that was in charge of basically coordinating.
And it wasn't just him. It was
a
group of attorneys general.
Right. Yeah. So you can criticize him all you want about the Trump rally and did he use tax money for that. But the ultimate trip, which is a large majority of where it went to, I think is justified as he was invited as in his official capacity.
He needs to pay it back. And I think at the end of the day.
All of it?
It's $2,500.
Which I can say it's just $2,500.
Not to the average family, and that's the thing. And at the end of the day,
even though we're getting $1 billion back,
this party keeps showing Hoosiers that they are
how long?
This party keeps showing Hoosiers that they're literally the Tammy Faye Jim Baker of the Republican Party now. They're grifters. They literally are all about culture wars and talking points, and they're going to abuse the system every single time because if the shoe were on the other foot, and it were a Democrat, we all know the Republicans not only would have basically lit themselves on fire, they'd be traveling the state talking about it.
All right, finally, March Madness is upon us. Time to ask for two predictions. First, with IU bounced, who wins the men's tournament? Let's go around. Start with Chris.
I have Purdue in the Final Four, but I have them being beat by the eventual champions, Gonzaga.
Gonzaga.
Okay, I was going to say Gonzaga, but now I know this one.
They got a
crew. Gonzaga's a really good
team.
I love IU, but Purdue, and I think, can do this. I'm a homer. So
I think Gonzaga's take it, too. Can the IU women's team make a deep run? Chris.
Absolutely. 4 seed last year, 3 seed this year.
Final Four.
Sweet 16.
Hey, we can agree on something. Yes.
I think Final Four, too. That's Indiana Week in Review for this week. Our panel is Democrat Drew Anderson, Republican Chris Mitchum, John Schwannis of Indiana Lawmakers, and Nikki Kelly of the Fort Wayne Journal-Gazette. If you'd like a podcast of this program, you can find it at WFYI.org/IWIR, or starting Monday, you can stream it or get it on demand from Xfinity and on the WFYI app. I'm Brandon Smith of Indiana Public Broadcasting. Join us next time, because a lot can happen in an Indiana week.
The opinions expressed are solely those of the panelists. Indiana Week in Review is a WFYI production in association with Indiana's public broadcasting stations.